So, to help me feel connected to you, would you let me know that you can hear me? Thank you so much. Nice to feel connected. So, I'll begin by saying something about the strategy of being on retreat. It's more obvious when we go on a organized retreat where we're all together in person that it is an artificial environment. It's an environment that's been constructed and with a lot of care and a lot of love, hopefully, but put together in such a way that it supports people to become calm, or how I prefer to say it, to become non-agitated. And so generally, retreat centers are in quiet places. Generally, we do this very artificial thing for human beings when they're together in groups. We don't talk much in silence. Sometimes we walk around slowly. We don't have a lot of work to do. We put aside our involvement with reading the news or being on the phone or all kinds of things we put aside, and it's for the purpose of becoming unagitated. Not because unagitated is so great in and of itself, which it is, but rather unagitated is a way of discovering all kinds of things that can't be discovered if you're agitated. One of the things that eventually you might discover is how wonderful you are. That if you go through the layers of a different kind of artificiality that has been constructed and built up over sometimes a lifetime, the artificial constructs or ideas that I'm not wonderful, that I may be horrible, or some variation of that. That's also a construct. That's also an artificial thing that gets created over time. And what happens with as we go into an environment that helps us to be not agitated, we slowly realize that those thoughts, those ideas of kind of thinking bad about ourselves, are themselves a form of agitation. And some people find it hard to question whether it's okay to drop their negative self-talk. But it might be easier to drop the idea that I'm supposed to be agitated. And so as the agitation drops away, we go through these layers of agitation that we live by, and it becomes simpler and simpler in our hearts, in our minds. And we start to discover how we are without all the artificial constructs, all the conditioning that we've built up maybe over a lifetime and that we've inherited from maybe sometimes family and society and challenging experiences that we have in life. And it's a phenomenal gift to give to oneself and to give to the world to be able to reduce the level of agitation in the mind to discover how wondrous you are, how wondrous we are. To discover that is to then also be able to give that as a gift to others. Though some people probably already know that about you, it's just hard sometimes to see it for ourselves. So on retreat, we can make this, environment for that purpose. But it also is a little bit artificial. And sometimes it becomes a kind of a shortcut to some level of peace or sense of well-being where we drop all the usual concerns. But that itself sometimes is doesn't involve any real inner work. It's just putting things aside, dropping them for a while so we can be peaceful. The real work of Dharma is to have enough calm, enough non-agitation, that we can really begin understanding and looking at what agitates us and discover maybe we don't need to keep that agitation going. We want to become wise about what goes on in our psychology and our inner life. Only then, when you're wise about to understand it well, only then can you really put it to rest. But to put it to rest because all the conditions are just right, then you become a little bit like those monks that Nikki talked about this morning, where the world has to be just right so that I can be peaceful. What about a peace that's portable, that you bring with you everywhere you go, and your peace is not affected, not lost, because of the challenges around you? Is that possible? I would say yes. That's the whole kind of direction that Dharma practice is going, is to have not a peace that's conditional, dependent on things just being all right around you, but a peace, well-being, wisdom, that's portable, that you carry with you into situations that are far from ideal. And then you don't have to change the conditions around you in order to have access to your peace. So this wondrous thing, this is what I wanted to emphasize. This wondrous, this beauty, this fantastic thing that you are. I want to, and so to develop confidence and appreciation and respect for ourselves is such a one part of this wonderful potential of this Dharma practice. And that's one of the reasons we practice, because that non-agitation really becomes embodied when we sit and with confidence. We sit with respect for ourselves. We sit with valuing and appreciating who we are. And is that okay for Buddhists to do? I mean, there's this teaching, right? Not self, no self, non-self. So we're not supposed to even use the word self when we're Buddhists, because then we get in trouble. Right? So heaven forbid that I use the word self today. But I want to read you a wonderful page out of a book, or it's actually not a book, I think it's an academic article. It's not very often I get to read an academic piece in a Dharma talk. And the title of the article is quite intriguing, but I'll save that for the end. So there's this wonderful Buddhist scholar named Joy Manet. And Joy Manet writes this. At a recent conference, whose theme was the psychology of awakening, Buddhism, science, and psychotherapy, many of the participants expressed their confusion regarding how the Buddha could function in the world without a self. Because they were Buddhists, they were trying to follow the teaching and to achieve or to imitate what they imagined this form of functioning could be. I thought they had missed the point. What the texts show in the character of the Buddha is someone with a very advanced self-concept. His self-esteem is perfect. He has gone beyond doubt. He knows, and he is confident in his knowledge. He expresses himself with conviction. When the Buddha talks of himself in the first person, he does so with clarity. He has a strong sense of identity and knows very well who he is. He gives accounts of his life experiences in the first person. He gives accounts of his spiritual capacities in the first person. For example, he announces and proclaims that he is a Buddha, and he says what a Buddha is. He gives first-person accounts of the capacities required of him by society. For example, he insists he is a competent debater. He discusses at ease and in full equality with kings and other notables. He defends himself and his teaching against unjust accusations and false representations. It is clear that the Buddha's, in quotation marks, self, as this concept is understood in contemporary psychology and psychotherapy, namely, a clear sense of identity, the ability to function competently and realistically in the world, to have a standard of ethics, to achieve one's goals, to interact with people, to make good choices, and so forth, was fully functional and remarkably well developed, as one would expect. Neither psychotherapy nor meditation is possible unless the sense of identity or ego is mature and well grounded. Otherwise, there is nothing to change and nothing to go beyond. So I don't know if I agree with every single thing she says, but boy, is she confident in her writing. And she expresses the Buddha in this wonderful, confident way. And I think a lot of it's quite true. It's remarkable how amazingly confident the Buddha was. And all the things he said about him, you know, that he showed up in this clear sense of knowing who he was and in relationship to other people. So this teaching of not self is not a teaching of being self-effacing or self-denying. Maybe it's a teaching of shedding an unnecessary agitation. And one of the great sources of agitation is around these issues of self and identity. But that doesn't mean we let go of all the self thing. Here we have an example of someone who became very self-confident. So part of what we do in this practice is, in fact, to let go of what stands in the way of us taking our place in this world, standing tall, being confident. It's not an easy task. And society and family has turned tremendous challenges, put up tremendous challenges for people to be able to feel this for themselves. And without knowing that this is the North Star, without knowing that this is the direction we're going, it might be easy to make it harder for oneself than we realize. So how can we attain or accomplish this kind of strong confidence, presence, inner strength, inner respect? How can we build to that and attain it and get it so that in a way that is doable for us, in a way that motivates us, in a way that the very effort to do so, however long it takes, is part and parcel of that confidence. So we're not so likely to be discouraged by the length of time it takes Because we see the value of confidence in the effort and engagement in it. So I said that we lower our, we let go of agitation so we can see how wondrous we are. There was a song that came out, I think, in the early 1990s that I like quite a bit. And I won't sing it to you because I would agitate you. But I will do what I hope is the next best thing as I tell you it. I'll first do the verse, just mostly one verse, as I remember how it actually is. And then I'll restate it for the purposes of our retreat. How could anyone ever tell you that you're anything less than beautiful? Anyone ever tell you you are less than whole? How could anyone fail to notice that your loving is a miracle? How deeply we're connected by the heart. That's the Buddhist ending. I think in the original one it says in the soul, I believe. So then, another version for the retreat. That maybe someday you'll be able to say it this way. How could anyone ever tell me that I'm anything less than beautiful? How could anyone ever tell me I am less than whole? How could anyone fail to notice that my loving is a miracle? How deeply I'm connected by my heart. Imagine singing that for yourself, to yourself. Now, one of the advantages of really being able to say that for yourself in a full way, then you're prepared to say the next retreat verse for this retreat version. How could anyone ever tell us that we are anything less than beautiful? How could anyone ever tell us that we are less than whole? How could anyone fail to notice that our loving is a miracle? How deeply we're connected by our hearts. So I think this is true, but it's not often known and understood. But you know, that's partly what we're doing in this practice, is to relax enough and trust enough and to risk enough to believe in ourselves and to love ourselves and to feel and to believe that we are something wondrous. It's a risk well worth taking. So the Buddha didn't sing that song, but he had his own kind of way of saying it. He said, and this is one of the, I'm very touched that he's one of the last things he taught before he died. I said the other day that he was the three heavenly messengers, sickness, old age, and death before he died and when he died. He was also the fourth heavenly messenger. He was the monk that he had seen when he was young. He was in the same role. So he said, make yourself a refuge Make yourself an island with no one else as your refuge, no one else as your island. I'll tell you later, then he explains how you do that. But to make yourself a refuge. Refuge is the fundamental act of faith in Buddhism. To go for refuge is to say you have faith, you have confidence, trust in this whole practice. So we talk a lot about going for refuge in Buddha Dharma Sangha. The Buddha actually never told anyone to do that. Isn't that remarkable? Buddhists have been doing it for 2,500 years, but the Buddha never told anyone to go for refuge in the Buddha Dharma and the Sangha. The instruction he gave about refuge was to be your own refuge. And then he continued his song, in a sense, and he said, even closer to his dying, he said, I have made of myself a refuge. I have made of myself a refuge. And this is also a very significant statement. Rather than saying that, oh, I've discovered it, there's an inherent refuge inside of me. There's some wonderful divinity inside of me or something that I've discovered what it is. There's something about how he lived his life, what he did, that you make a refuge. And this is maybe a difficult lesson. We kind of want to have the reassurance that we are fundamentally a refuge, or there's some fundamental divine thing inside that really we can rely on. And in a sense, there is. But for the Buddha, it was something we happens from how we live our life and what we do. And so one of the things that the Buddha said, encouraged us to have confidence in, have faith in, it's kind of a risky topic. Some people are challenged by the idea of faith and the idea we're supposed to have faith. But he said, that, excuse me, this is my only one. He said, he encouraged us to have faith in what is wholesome, in what is skillful, in the activities, the actions, the thoughts, the actions of body, speech, and mind that are wholesome, to have faith in that. The word wholesome can also mean skillful. There, I like to translate it sometimes as helpful. Have faith in what is helpful. It can also mean ethical. Have faith in what is ethical. It can also mean virtuous. Have faith in what is virtuous. And there's one word, this word kusala has all these wonderful meanings. So he said, have faith in what's kusala actions. And faith itself is kusala, is a healthy, helpful thing to have. So what are the helpful things to do? What are now we're talking about taking refuge in what we can do rather than refuge in what we can be. So when the Buddha said that make yourself a refuge, your own refuge, and he said, how can you be your own refuge? In practicing mindfulness. Mindfulness is a kind of a doing. Sometimes it's almost like a not doing. But to take refuge in, when you take refuge in yourself, you're taking refuge in your capacity to be aware. And the kind of awareness that mindfulness is always wholesome. It's always helpful. And so the task is to discover, what, how can you be aware in a way that is helpful, that's supportive, that feels right, that feels wholesome, feels healthy. I think each person who practices mindfulness would ideally ask that question of themselves and discover for themselves, how is it you are mindful, pay attention to what's going on, aware of this world? So the awareness itself is healthy, is beneficial, is wholesome. One of the things it would mean is that the awareness would not be entangled with all kinds of unnecessary baggage. I know I've had all kinds of baggage connected to my practice of mindfulness. One of them was, I realized this when I was sitting on retreat and with all the people sitting around me. And it was kind of a syndrome, like grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. Their meditation is really good. Everyone's meditation is good, but mine. So that was kind of heavy baggage to carry along. So every moment of awareness, it was kind of like not so conscious. It took a while to see how unconscious that attitude was. But every little moment of awareness I had was tainted with this idea that I wasn't doing it right. If I was doing it, it was not right. That was like the policy. So whatever I did, of course, it was wrong. So it was, you know, again, it was not so conscious, but it kind of made it heavy and a little tense, you know, what I was doing. So after a while, I got to see that. Or then there was the idea that I'm supposed to get concentrated. And so then, you know, that was the baggage. And I could, again, I started seeing that when I started getting little headaches when I meditated, because I was trying, you know, to get concentrated. I was a slow learner sometimes. And then there was the idea that, you know, I'm not good enough. This is too hard. This is going to take too long. You know, can we speed this up? Because, you know, there's important movies on Netflix. That's important things to do. And so all these things, you know, that was kind of, it was kind of, I could feel this little impatience in how I was being mindful. And then there was a times where I resisted being mindful. I was engaged in doing it kind of, but I really didn't want to admit what was happening. I didn't want to see and tell myself and face what was really happening. And so, you know, I was skirting around, I was pulling back, I was kind of, mindfulness was kind of dull so that I couldn't have to really deal with it. And so then the mindfulness was kind of mixed up with that kind of resistance. A convenient list for this process of coming to a wholesome mindfulness are the five hindrances. And kind of look and see, any of these hindrances present as I'm being mindful? Maybe kind of almost like under the surface, kind of sneaking along. Is there some kind of desire that's entangled with awareness? Is there some kind of hostility, ill will, aversion? Is there some kind of resistance that takes the form of sloth and torpor? Is there some kind of anxiety or self-challenge that gives rise to agitation and remorse? Is there some kind of doubt that goes along with being mindful? I've had that, like every moment of mindfulness was just kind of colored by, no, this can't be it. This is not right. Or really? Or what do I do here? Or what's happening here? So it's really good news, believe it or not, to see these things about oneself. It's really good news because then you can begin questioning it. Then you can begin looking for how can I adjust my awareness so the awareness is simple. Very, very simple. No agendas. So the awareness is generous. It has a softness to it or a kindness to it. The kind of way in which when you had a difficult day and someone sat down next to you and just to be with you and be your companion, your company you, and not to fix you, not to change you, not to criticize you for anything, just there with you. For the mindfulness to have that kind of attention, that kind of awareness. I'm just here with you. I'm here fully here, present. I'm just going to be here with you. So to have confidence in what is wholesome is one of the ways we start developing this inner confidence that can grow. And have confidence that it's actually wise to see what is not so wholesome, not so healthy. And so rather than being discouraged, feel a kind of Dharma encouragement when you see something about yourself that is a little bit off. You know, look at that. I'm just a little bit angry or a little bit resentful or a little bit this or that or very much this or that. Oh, I'm a Dharma practitioner. I'm a mindfulness student. I'm supposed to see this stuff. That's what I signed up for. It finally showed up. Maybe sooner than I wished. And now it gives us a chance to work with it, to find our bearing, to take a stand, sit straight, metaphorically so, discover how not to be pushed around by it or burdened by it. And if you were there last night when I gave the reflections, or if you weren't there, there is something very valuable about taking a posture, physical posture, that the posture itself expresses confidence. And then allow your lack of confidence to kind of bounce around inside of that confident structure, place. I remember many years ago, I was so restless. And I just sat really still, upright and still. And it got to be fascinating to watch, like ping pong balls bouncing off my insides around, just bouncing this way and that way. And after a while, it got disturbing. Because I had the ability to not give in to the restlessness, but to stay upright and still. It's not faking it. It's not pretending. But it's contributing a posture, physical posture that you can hold, has the capacity to be with whatever inner life is showing itself at any given time. There's a reference point. There's a little place of physical freedom. Even if the body is expressing a lot of strong emotions, the posture is holding it in a different way. So now, one of the wholesome things to have confidence in is goodwill, metta. How can anyone fail to notice that your loving is a miracle? How can anyone fail to notice that you're beautiful? The Buddha used the word beauty, beautiful, quite a bit. And you wouldn't know it because the translators into English have kind of flattened the language in when they do English translations. And some of the beauty of the and the richness of the language gets lost in English. And so some of you know the word Kalyanamitta, and it's usually translated into English as good spiritual friend. That's not so flat. That's kind of nice, spiritual friend. But the word Kalyana literally means beautiful. A beautiful friend. Do you have a beautiful friend? Can you be a beautiful friend for someone? Can you be a Kalyanamitta? These wholesome states of mind that were wholesome activities, wholesomeness, the Buddha says to have confidence, you're supposed to have confidence in. Sometimes rather than being called wholesome, they're called beautiful. I love the Native American idea of walking in beauty. Can you walk in beauty? Can you sit in beauty? Can you eat in beauty? Can you meditate in beauty? Can you love in beauty? So what's the connection between non-agitation and kindness? What's the connection between non-agitation and beauty? What's the connection between awareness and goodwill? I think of all of these kind of as a wonderful ecosystem, a wonderful partners, mutually connected, mutually part of the same whole. How can anyone ever tell you you're anything less than whole? And so to be able to have goodwill, I like the expression goodwill as a translation for metta because it's kind of accessible, I believe. It might be a little bit dry, but loving kindness as a translation is inspiring. But also, it kind of creates a high bar. And just like the word care, it's kind of, goodwill is kind of humble and simple. Always have goodwill, even for the people you don't like. And of course, it'd be nice to have love for your enemies. But maybe that's a little bit too challenging many times in our lives. And to set up to do something that's challenging all the time, have it, you know, always as being this high standard, can be kind of discouraging. But goodwill is maybe a simpler. Always have goodwill. And why always have goodwill? So here's a interesting statement. I hope it's true. At least I believe that anytime there's not any goodwill, we're probably agitated. One of the reasons to not be agitated is so that our goodwill, kindness or care can be there for each other. So I want to read you a description of loving, discussion of loving kindness. That comes from a text called the Treatise on the Paramis. It's written so many centuries after the Buddha. The perfection of goodwill is the wish to provide for the welfare and happiness of the world, accompanied by care and skillful means. Literally, it means benevolence. Goodwill is mentioned immediately after the perfection of resolve because goodwill perfects the determination to undertake activity for the welfare of others. The noble qualities of goodwill should be reflected upon thus. One resolved only upon their own welfare cannot achieve success in this world or a happy rebirth in the life to come. There must be some concern for the welfare of others. How then can someone wishing to establish all beings in the attainment of liberation succeed without goodwill? And if you wish to ultimately lead all beings to the achievement of freedom, you should begin by wishing for their mundane success here and now. So there's a very interesting juxtaposition here. One resolved only upon one's own welfare cannot achieve success in this world. There must be some concern for the welfare of others. So this goodwill, that's such a big part of the practice, is something that goes in all directions. Goodwill to oneself, goodwill to others, goodwill to all of us together. Basic well-wishing. And I found it very interesting as a practice to, when I don't have goodwill, some very basic, simple friendliness, to take a good look at what's happening to me. It's kind of like a little alarm bell that goes off. Say, oh, this is worthwhile stopping for and taking a good look. What's happening now? Why would I give my goodwill up? What is worthwhile sacrificing my goodwill for? My friendliness. And maybe if you ask that question of yourself, maybe the answers you have, maybe a few of them, won't seem reasonable. Especially if you think of goodwill as one of the greatest things you have going. So when the Buddha says to have confidence, is not simply to have confidence in goodwill, but have confidence, take refuge in your capacity to do wholesome things, your capacity to have goodwill, your capacity to have mindfulness, your capacity to be ethical. And if you can't be ethical, for whatever reason that's impossible for you, because of who knows why, your capacity to want to be ethical. Your capacity to not cause harm. These are wholesome things. These are wholesome things. So when we sit and meditate on retreat, whether you know it or not, it is a time where wholesome qualities are being cultivated. And one of them, which is confidence. And I say it so that you, when the time comes, when you feel ready, you'll recognize it in yourself and see it as a refuge, see it as a support for you to be confident, for you to be able to stand your ground in this metaphorical sense, stand tall, to hold yourself as being important, to hold yourself as someone who is respect-worthy, to have a deep respect for yourself and not to do something that would undermine that respect, not to do something that causes harm. Or to say it in a different way, not to do something that agitates you with remorse and regrets and with needing to defend yourself or to explain yourself or defend yourself in all kinds of ways, but to be able to be calm, upright, settled, stable, to be able to have access to well-being, happiness, joy. I love it that this scholar who wrote this wonderful page about the Buddha, her first name is Joy. Maybe it's just a coincidence. I told you the name of the title of the article that she wrote. The article was, I'll get the title exact. Let me see if I can find it here. Oh. Anyway, it's called, Was the Buddha a Shaman? Isn't that a kind of evocative title for, Was the Buddha a Shaman? So, you're not supposed to be, you don't have to become a shaman. But I do hope that you'll be someone who recognizes their own beauty. I hope you become someone who recognizes your own value. And it's hard to have that kind of self-confidence. And so the way that it's developed over time is in small steps. Small little doing things and becoming confident, oh, I can do this. Maybe it can be, you can go through a day or an hour or maybe for 10 minutes and not say anything mean to anyone. Say, wow, I did it, 10 minutes. Wow. As opposed to, all I could do was 10 minutes. Oh, that's the disappointment at that only 10 minutes, that doesn't build confidence. But the celebrating, I did 10 minutes without a mean word. Wow, maybe tomorrow I'll do 11. And you know, by the end of the year, you do 365. That's like 6 hours of your waking day. That's pretty cool. A minute a day. So small little steps. I can do it there. I can do it there. I can do it there. Yes. And it grows and develops. And then after a while, you have confidence that in your ability to do these small steps. And I can do small steps. And then after a while, you realize, I can do small steps forever through anything. And I have confidence. I can be upright, stand tall, be calm, and I can't figure out what to do, but I can, I don't understand everything, but I can do that small step. The next moment, I can show up for the next moment. I can put my foot down in the right place on the ground for the next moment. I know how to do that. I don't know where I'm going, but I know My foot goes down here. I know how to be mindful of the next moment. I don't understand what's happening in this complex world, but this moment, I know where I am. I'm here and now. And it counts. So all this comes together. Confidence, beauty, respect, goodwill. And engagement. Doing the practice. Buddhist practice is not magical thinking, waiting for something to happen that's going to take care of you, waiting for the big bang of enlightenment. Buddhist practice is a lot of small steps of you making yourself a refuge. Being the refuge, having confidence in the wholesome, and doing all this in a way that not only is not agitating, but is deactivating, de-agitating. And how do you do that? How do you have a wholesome mindfulness? How do you engage in the doing so that it's settling and calming? That's the task for you to discover. That's up to you. It's a noble and very meaningful endeavor that is a gift that you give to the world. We need more people who engage in this discovery process of how to do this. And on this retreat, it's a great conditions to keep exploring, keep developing, keep engaging in this process. And in the process, I hope you discover that you're beautiful. Thank you.